Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
Hit your money goals without switching platforms. Download SoFi's all-in-one super app for industry-leading APY, great loan rates, and stock trading. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank, NA, NMLS, 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. All right, welcome to the Monday edition of the On the Tape podcast. I'm Dan Nathan, joined as always by Guy Adami and Liz Young, EY from SoFi. Welcome, people.
Hello.
So we got
best
a little
day of the week.
Yeah, we got a little March madness, a little March sadness for Guy and me. You're Marquette. You're going to the dance, guys.
We are, but we lost the Big East tournament.
I know, guys. Hoyas.
Hold on a second. What is the sadness? I'm missing something.
Yeah, your Hoyas not going. My Orange
Wait a second. Hold on.
Yeah.
Was there a question? Were they a bubble team? Were they disappointed?
No.
I mean, I could have told you that last March.
Yes,
that
you could.
They weren't going.
You could have done
this March,
but there is a little sadness. So we're going to root for Liz's Marquette squad. There, we got a little housekeeping here. We got a busy week at Risk Reversal Media. You know that we have the market call that is Monday through Thursday on the Risk Reversal Media YouTube page at 1 p.m. Eastern. Carter Braxton Worth will be with us tomorrow. Liz will be with us on Wednesday. We're going to be covering all
Fed
the
day.
Fed stuff. Yes, you will. You're going to be going down to the NYSE right afterwards and doing the closing bell during the presser. That it's going to be exciting. We also have a special OTT drop on Thursday. We have the Compound Bros. That would be downtown Josh Brown and Mike Batnick. They're going to sit down with me, and that drops on Thursday. And then Danny Moses is going to be doing a What Are We Doing with Vinny Porter. And I believe Steve Eisman is going to be joining. That's going to be dropped on Friday on the normal On the Tape podcast. So check all of that out. Guys, we had a busy week. We previewed it a little bit last week. The Fed two-day meeting that obviously culminates with the presser on Wednesday. We also have this GTC, this user conference for NVIDIA. People are all geeked up about that. We are recording this right before the opening on Monday morning. Last week, it looked like we had a little bit of a, I don't know, like a little come down for some of the tech stuff. We had the NASDAQ close down 1% on Friday. Right now, as we speak, it's up 70 basis points. That's the NASDAQ 100. What do we want to do? Let's do jump ball. What do we think is more important
right here? Jump ball. Well, if we're doing a jump ball, I'm going to dominate Elizabeth.
Yeah. We just talked about how tall I'm not.
You know, she's half my
That's
size.
Not fair.
I mean, but as they say, you know, I'm not going to be a gentleman today. I'm just going to take this ball and run with it, Dan. and I'll say, again, the fact that CPI came in and then PPI came in last week, much hotter. Again, for whatever reason, the market, at least today, this morning, wants to focus on other things and want to focus around some of the exuberance around, as you mentioned, this NVIDIA announcement unveiling, as it were, and good for them. And clearly people get excited about that. But right before our very eyes, Dan, we have crude oil, again, north of $80 in WTI. We have 10-year yields north of 4.3%. And we have a market, at least today, for these first few hours pre-open, that doesn't seem to care. I happen to think, though, that the, some of the damage we saw last week and some of the things we heard last week are going to permeate for the balance of this week in terms of the S&P 500 to the downside.
Yeah, Liz, and one thing I would say is that, you know, when you think about this, we're front-end loaded with a little of the AI stuff with obviously what's going on with NVIDIA. We wake up this morning, we'll hit this in a couple minutes, with this story out of Bloomberg that Apple, which has no generative AI strategy, is talking to the Google, which their gen AI strategy in Gemini has not gone particularly well. That stock has really underperformed, but that stock's trading up 5%. I think that's helping the NASDAQ this morning on the potential for a tie up there. But then very quickly, I think the stuff that Guy just mentioned, the stuff that you were talking about with us last week about, you know, inflation and really the pace of rates and what is becoming embedded, that is clearly going to be, I think, the back half of this week, the story here.
Absolutely. And this is another one of those weeks. This is like my Super Bowl. I get a lot of these a year, so I'm lucky. But this Fed week, obviously nobody expects the Fed to move. I still don't expect the Fed to move. But I think there's a few things that could happen. And leading off the week with this NVIDIA enthusiasm, natural because that's the way momentum has been going. I think the market probably doesn't care about it today because we still believe, we as in the big we as the market, still believe that the Fed is going to be there and they're going to cut eventually and they're going to support this and the put is back in place. I think that that's the underlying support. If the Fed changes that tune, I think some of the wheels start to fall off the bus. And we have to be careful here. So back in mid to late December, I started to say, you know what, this rally is probably real, at least for the meantime. So just ride it. I think we are now getting to the point where the rally maybe isn't going to turn completely over, but it's stalled, it's plateaued. And now we're waiting for other things to pick up the slack, which some of them have. But this is that big question mark of, can the rally continue, create a new leg upward? And in order for that to happen, I think we do need the Fed support. I think that there is a decent chance that in this presser, Jerome Powell walks back some of the more dovish tone that he had or that was interpreted by the market over the last month or so. And don't forget, we get a dot plot, which I think there's going to be perhaps some movement in the dots and perhaps some movement in their summary of economic projections. And the market is going to have to digest that. So this is probably a pretty big week, and this is a week where we're going to likely change expectations about when that first cut is coming. And as it draws nearer, that's when the market starts to get more and more nervous, as we know.
Guy, do you think he will walk back some of the dovish speak? And again, so Liz is basically articulating the fact that the market from this point on needs the Fed support here. And it's interesting, you know, to your point about where yields are, where some of the inflation readings are, where crude oil is, it doesn't seem like there's a whole heck of a lot of reasons. You're going to have to make the case why all of that data is going to start to turn or kind of turn the economy into a weaker sort of economy, at least the way it's being perceived, for the Fed to start to support it. But you've made the case all along, okay, why higher for longer is likely to be the story, even as the market, the stock market, was rallying, right, in that December-January period. Because if they do get easy, then it will just restoke some of the kind of inflation sort of fears, right? And that's how it becomes embedded in the economy. And ultimately, we end in this stagflationary environment, which should not be good for risk assets or valuations.
Yeah, to answer your question directly, I'll say this. You know, your question was, will he walk back some of the dovish comment? I happen to think, and Elizabeth has thoughts on this, I'm sure, but I don't necessarily know that he's been dovish at all. I mean, maybe the interpretation has been that, and people hear what they want to hear. That's, Danny says it all the time, but, you know, I give the guy credit where credit is due. You know, I think he's been somewhat steadfast in his desire to combat inflation and his notion that, you know, we're not there yet. We have not succeeded yet. And I think he is a student of history. And as much as people want to say it's different than the early 1970s, yeah, in some ways it is different, but in a lot of ways it's not. I mean, they don't want to make the same mistakes they made 51 or 52 years ago when they thought they had slayed the dragon, only to have it come back that much more angry in the ensuing years in the mid-70s. So look, the last couple readings have, it, to me, sort of galvanized my thought that we're going to see a reacceleration of inflation. We're seeing it. I mean, you could say that the numbers are, you know, there's no straight line and it's lumpy and it's just a one-off or two. But I happen to think that we're starting to see it. And by the way, we're starting to see it in some of the underlying commodities. I mentioned crude oil. You're starting to see it in copper as well. And that, to me, is next to crude, probably the second most important commodity out there in terms of the inflation story.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. You just happened to say it much better than I did. I think that he's been very consistent. And I keep saying that he's been very consistent. And then I hear these stories about how he pivoted and he's turned all very dovish. I don't understand necessarily where that's coming from. He had continued to say, we need to feel confident that inflation is on a sustainable path toward 2%. We are not confident of that yet. And then we interpret it as a pivot. So yes, he did hint at some point this year, it will be appropriate to start cutting rates. It's March. We've got a long year ahead. And if the market is expecting that first cut to come in June, what if it doesn't come until September? And then remember the record that I mentioned last week. If we make it to November and they haven't cut rates yet, it will be the longest time that they've waited between the last hike and the first cut. We get to September and it's right around that record back from 2006. So I don't understand it either. I don't understand why the market is interpreting it that way. The other thing is the fact that the market is interpreting him as dovish has loosened financial conditions on their own. So that actually, it's a bad self-fulfilling prophecy. You loosen financial conditions further, the Fed is less apt to cut rates because the market has already done it. So why do they need to?
Guy, let's talk a little bit about the market's reaction to this. The realization that, again, higher for longer is here, as long as some of that economic data, continues chugging along, despite the fact we saw the unemployment rate tick up, all the inflation readings, that sort of thing. I mean, at some point, doesn't the stock market, this was another record, Liz, that you talked about, I think, in your note last week and on the pod last week about the S&P without it.
One day, 2% correction.
So we are now almost like on the anniversary of a one-year period where the S&P has not had a 2% drawdown. I mean, Guy, just think about that. I mean, like, you know, even in the years of zero interest rate policy, you know what I mean? I feel like that was something that caused some volatility here and there. We haven't even had any downward volatility. And even in the period of last October, I guess we didn't have a 2% drawdown. I mean, that's crazy.
I think the high of the S&P was on March 12th, if I'm not mistaken, 5189 and change. The indications, again, we're doing this before the open, as you mentioned, but you know, if we open where we're indicated to open, we're going to be within, you know, 0.5% or so of an all-time high made just basically a week and a half or so ago, which is remarkable given the fact that you felt like you had some pretty violent sell-offs last week, yet you wake up and the market's still here. So to answer that question, am I surprised by it? Absolutely surprised. Am I surprised the fact that, you know, Apple's not performed until obviously the indication this morning on the back of this and we're still able to hold serve? Absolutely am I surprised. So there's so many things that have me here scratching my head, yet the market continues to do the grind. The VIX appears like it wants to party, only to have that pull back. The market's doing this in the face, as I mentioned, of some of these commodities, in the face of 10-year yields going from 3.8% to 4.3%, headed higher, I think. It is quite remarkable, but I do think it's just a matter of time before this catches up the entirety of the entire situation. And I'm glad Elizabeth mentioned the unemployment rate. You know, I think that's going to catch people off sides as well. You know, I think it's going to start to move in a meaningful way to the upside, which should lead to rate cuts. Of course, the problem is the inflation data continues to be stubborn. So they're in a bit of a pickle here, I think.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that the MOVE index that tracks the Treasury yield volatility is trading at, I want to say, very near two-year lows right here. And when you think about that, we've had this steady march up from 3.8% to 4.33% where we're looking at it right here. You know, something's got to give there. And maybe it is the sort of thing, maybe it's that 4.5% range. Guy, you've been pretty steadfast that you thought we'd get back there. And you didn't rule out a retest of the 5% in the 10-year. I just just can't imagine when you think about where the S&P was when the 10-year was in that 4.5 to 5% range on the upside. Equity holders were not particularly happy about that. And I just don't like, you know, Liz, you use this term late cycle all the time. You know, if we are to get back, if you see some of the data that we're seeing in the economy, and we do have a 10-year yield above 4.5%, I just can't imagine that equity investors were going to feel pretty good about holding, you know, stocks at all-time highs after what we already know and the likelihood of basically a weakening economy that will work its way into risk assets.
Yeah. If we're mid-cycle, the economy isn't weakening. And if we're mid-cycle, the unemployment rate isn't rising. And if we're mid-cycle, we don't have re-accelerating inflation. So I think what would actually happen, the people that are in mid-cycle camp, I understand that there's data to support that and that some of the market behavior can support that. If the Fed cuts rates too soon, I can almost guarantee you that we end up in late cycle very quickly because it overheats again. And then you end up in a place where you're chasing inflation again. And that's what they really don't want to do. So even if we're not in late cycle right now, they cut too early and we will be there very quickly. So that's not something that we should wish for. One of the things that I think we should start watching in the market, this is going to be a very subtle shift, but on those days where there's a correction, you want to see what happens into the close. So if there's a drawdown intraday, are there buyers that come in and support it into the close? So does that drawdown become less deep as we get closer and closer to 4 p.m. Eastern time? Or does it deepen into the close? And that can show you a shift in sentiment. Now, what happened for the most part last week was that the drawdown got less dramatic toward the close. So people came in and bought the intraday dip. So that tells me that sentiment, risk appetite, still present, still reasonably healthy. If and when that shift occurs where you've got, let's say the Dow is down 200 points at noon, if it ends the day down 400 points, that's a shift in sentiment. That's an acceleration of a sell-off, and that does change things.
That's a really interesting point, Liz, and it leads me to a trend that we've seen in the market over the last year or so, the 0 days to expiration options. And guys talked about this. We've had plenty of guests talk about it, how it's actually been vol dampening, and it could be the very answer to what we're talking about, that 1 year sort of record that we're saying without a 2% peak to trough drawdown in a session. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, we'll put it in the show notes, how I got hooked on the hottest trade in markets and bagged a 2,000% return. And this Wall Street Journal reporter is talking about trading 0 days to expiration options. So think about this. If you have the market down, right, and you're a day trader and you can put basically buy a lotto ticket with defined risk between now, whenever you're buying that option, and the end of the day, right, you might go and do that. And you might pay pennies for that and register a big gain if you are in the camp, like you just laid out, that there are going to be dip buyers. And so I think a lot of this is perpetuating itself. Guy, you've asked the question of many folks smarter than me on the vol front, is this adding risk? Well, it's not adding a whole heck of a lot of risk if you have a bunch of retail committing, you know, a certain amount of premium to it that is defined. There is risk if they, on the other side of that, you have the dealers hedging, right? And then they have some sort of event that happens on one given day or whatever, or a pattern of days. And then you have some behavior that sorts of change. We just haven't seen that yet. And so I think it's interesting that you bring that up, Liz. And it's something that Guy and I have been talking about a lot on Market Call over the last year or so.
Yeah, one of the reasons I don't think the VIX is, and I mentioned the VIX earlier, but now I'm sort of contradicting myself a bit, but I don't think it's as valuable an indicator as it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, is because of some of these new products that are out there that are seemingly dampening volatility. And again, I'm not an expert in the construct of these 0 day to expiry, and theoretically, for every buyer or every seller, there is a buyer. So it shouldn't necessarily have the impact. My concern, of course, is, Dan, as you mentioned, it's not the people that are getting long these instruments. It's the people that are probably getting naked short these things and the effect they have on the underlying volatility and the potential for something to break. Again, we've seen it before. And it's volatility events that are seemingly the triggers for market movements. And, you know, as we continue to sort of push down the VIX in the form of many different things, not least of which a market that's convinced that the Fed is going to be there, the Fed is going to cut. The Fed obviously has a dampening effect as well. You know, my concern grows each day. I'd feel much better about things if we had a spike in vol on these sell-offs, but we're just not seeing it.
With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. SoFi, the all-in-one super app for banking, borrowing, and investing. Earn industry-leading APY, get great loan rates, and trade stocks. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA SIPC.
Let's talk about, you know, the AI situation here. We highlighted the fact that NVIDIA's GTC event is happening. There will be an analyst update, so there'll be Q&A. Jensen Huang, the CEO of the company, is giving a very long keynote. So this is going to be all things AI. The stock is in and around $900 as we speak. It closed the week at $878 last week. That all-time high, it was an intraday high from two Fridays ago, was $974, that we saw that very big reversal. That closed, you know, basically down $100 at current levels or so. It'll be interesting. Like, you know, to the point is, this is the story that's working. There's going to be a whole host of, you know, great news on the product front. There's probably going to be good news on the margin front. It's going to give investors a lot of confidence that they continue to kind of own the market share here, own the gross margin on these high-end graphics processors. But I got to tell you, this story today about two of the laggards, it's about Apple that has had no generative AI strategy, and it's been punished for it. If you just look at the chart here, you know, it's down 13-14%. It's trading up a little bit right now in the pre-market on this announcement. It's not even an announcement. It's basically speculation that Google and Apple are in talks. We know that Apple gets about $20 billion in traffic acquisition costs, an exclusive deal that they have with Google on search for their Safari browser. We know that Apple has an installed base of iOS users, about 2 billion. So if they were to embed Gemini into their iPhones, right, into all of their devices, this would seemingly give them a generative AI story, makes them competitive on the hardware front, makes it competitive with obviously what Microsoft's doing on the search front with OpenAI, but how they're integrating these products into their productivity suite and the like here. And again, you know, the fact that Google is trading back up near its prior highs. I think it's just below 150. The all-time high made a couple months ago was 154 before their earnings. It's clearly a much bigger vote of confidence in Google than it would be for Apple. But it's kind of a joke that Apple actually has to do a deal with basically the ugly redheaded stepchild in the space, which is Google. So, Guy, thoughts here, because, you know, Google feels like it's going to get back to those prior all-time highs, but they're one basically new gen AI product launch away from muffing it the way they have over the last, call it, year and a half or so, for basically just further eroding the confidence that the marketplace has in their product.
Yeah, I mean, two great companies that are lagging in that arena, seemingly, you know, again, I don't know the veracity of these comments, but let's just take it at face value and say there's something here. You know, sometimes when you put two negatives together, you get a positive. I mean, that's just math. Other times you put two negatives together, you just get a bigger negative. So the market's sort of figuring this thing out. But, you know, I think it's interesting if everybody, there was this phenomenon years ago when, for whatever reason, people like to hold their kids back, specifically young boys, because hoping by holding them back a grade or so, they'd get a leg up on their rivals, right? They'd be better suited for athletics in later years. But if everybody holds their kids back the same time, then you're right back to square one. My point is like, okay, now everybody's got this. Now what? Like we haven't, nobody's really proven to me how these companies are going to monetize this. And the more competition in the space, I think it just leads to, again, the margins that all these companies are enjoying, specifically NVIDIA, by definition, I think start to come down. So yeah, everybody can have AI. Everybody has their tools. That's great. Everybody's back at square one. Now what? And I think that's what the market is going to come to figure out over the next couple of weeks.
My parents did not get the holding back memo. I was July. My sister was October. They sent us both early. It was like sink or swim, kids.
Right.
It's not how it worked in my house. Interesting tidbit. This is anecdotal, perhaps. There's a book that was written in 1996. It's called Only the Paranoid Survive. I've read it once. I read it years ago. And I just purchased a new copy because I want to read it again. And this time I want to read it through the lens of how is this AI theme possibly going to play out. The idea of the book, it's about Intel, and it's about a shift that they made, a very bold shift that they made in the 90s to stop focusing on B2B and start focusing on the consumer and the actual user, the end user of the product, because they were making a bet that the personal computer would become something in households. And it worked. People thought Andrew Grove was crazy at the time to do it, but it worked. And you know what? If they hadn't done that, they would be obsolete as a company. It allowed them to shift into the next generation of technology. It allowed them to survive and not turn into Blockbuster or Kodak. And it turned out to be the best decision that he could have made, despite the pushback that he got. So I say that in reaction, and I don't know how this Apple Google thing is going to work out, but sometimes when you think it looks crazy, it's actually the smartest thing that companies can do, and you never know how it's going to shake out. And the other reason I say that is because one of the biggest reasons I want to reread the book is because of everything that's happening with NVIDIA. I want to go back and read about the competitive landscape and how different it is now than how we thought it was in the 90s. And this new theme of personal computers, who we thought were going to be the winners, those companies that we thought were going to be the winners, and now we know what happened. Did those actually turn out to be the winners? And there were a lot that didn't turn out to be the winners. So I'll let you know. I'll follow up with a book report.
A great companion to that, Chris Miller, the author of Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology, and actually details all of this and actually the competitive landscape. And, you know, Guy would sit here and tell you that was probably the last right move that Intel has made when you think about all of the computing shifts that they've actually missed since the PC and really their partnership with Microsoft and Wintel, as it was known. But Chip War was really great and actually does go deep into NVIDIA. And it tells a story of a company that's been innovating for decades now, and Jensen Huang has been at the helm of that. I'll just mention this, you know, when you think about those sorts of computing, shifts and the like, and who's at the forefront, I saw this tweet over the weekend from Elon Musk. And you know, here's a guy, there's been a lot of good headlines about his Grok. This is his large language model that they're training on a lot of data, you know, on Twitter and the like, and it wants to compete with OpenAI. And we know that he is, you know, suing OpenAI. He was one of the original founders of that organization. He tweeted this on Friday. There is either a red wave this November or America is doomed. Imagine four more years of this getting worse. And our friend at Wall Street Cynic, that would be Jim Chanos, who's been, you know, an Elon Musk watcher, a critic, he quote tweeted that and said, "Optimistic futurist sees dystopian hellscape if Orange Man not anointed as our red leader. Otherwise, the red planet beckons." And I think about this, and I think about the people that are in control of these technologies, dictating, you know what I mean, the thought in and around them right now, versus, let's say, an Andy Grove back then, who was really fighting for the future of his company, for the future of a vision of computing the way that he had seen it. And he had, Chip Wars talks about Grove, they were there in the 50s, these guys. You know what I mean? Like, and they were all guys, trust me. You know what I mean? Like, building out these technologies. And just think of what a different place we are right now, where these folks are litigating this on social media through the lens of politics. And Guy, politics, what do they do to you?
Well, I mean, the pushback on that is, you know, the people on the other side of the aisle will say, well, wait a second, you know, we're just catching up with what Facebook has done for years and what Google obviously has been doing, most specifically in the form of what we saw a couple weeks ago with that disastrous bit of story, you know, that story that came out in terms of, what is it, Gemini? So, you know, look, I get it. It's politics suck, and I understand what your point you're trying to make, but both sides are pretty much dug in at this point. So, you know, for every Elon Musk, there's somebody on the flip side of that coin.
But there isn't when it comes to Eli, the richest man in the world, who's the CEO of XAI, of Twitter, of SpaceX, of, you know, I mean, a Tesla, of the Boring Company, of Neuralink, of Starlink. I mean, like, that's the point. I'm just saying it's interesting because I did read Chip Ward. I want to read the book that Liz just mentioned. And when you just think of some of these folks and really the control and the power that they have, it's just kind of, it's a different time, what is what I'm saying. And listen, this is going on right now with TikTok, and it's a battle between, a foreign adversary that basically a company that is, you know, basically owned by the CCP and what they might have to do to compete here in the US versus what our companies have to do to compete over there and have access to their consumers, and our digital companies basically don't. So I'm just saying, you know, to quote The Wire again, the game's the same. It's just gotten more fierce. And some of the players here, I think, seem to be a bit more partisan than they have in the past. And I'm not sure they all have all of our best interests in mind. I don't know. Thoughts there, Liz?
Well, I'll give a very nonpartisan answer, that the best quote from the book I mentioned is, the greatest danger is in standing still. So I would interpret that as an investor as well, by saying, if you're betting on that one company, and the idea that this theme will not change and that you know who the winner is, the greatest danger is in standing still and assuming that that's going to persist for the next 5 to 10 years as this theme plays out.
Yeah. All right, Guy, if we are doing a pod at the end of the week, which we will be doing, how do you think the market, where do you think equities are here? Do you think we push to make a new high into the Fed? And then if the, you know, Fed chair kind of stays his course, which, again, I think it's really interesting listening to the two of you. You know, I thought he had gotten particularly hawkish as we got into the new year a little bit, and those kind of rate cut odds had been pushed out. But then, to Guy's point, a lot of folks were hearing a level of dovishness, right? Despite the strong economic data and the like here. How do the markets react to this? Because again, we're going to have good news out of NVIDIA. We have good news in the AI landscape in general here. You know, we have a broadening out of the stock market that a lot of bulls have kind of like said, this is a great thing here. But then we also have a Fed that's contending with the reemergence of inflation here. And at some point, we got to have Liz's record broken there about a 2% down day, Guy.
The reality is financial conditions, and, you know, Liz made this point earlier, I mean, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, they have gotten looser. And we're looking at an S&P 500 as we're sitting here now within, you know, 0.5% or so, or less than that of its all-time high, which, again, is remarkable. I mean, you go back last week, you felt like you had some pretty dramatic sell-offs, and then you wake up and here we are again, the ability to continue to claw back in the face of a lot of what I think has been disappointing news and some disappointing earnings report and disappointing individual stock stories doesn't seem to factor in at all. But to answer that question specifically, you know, I think the news this week, I think people are sort of geeked up on this NVIDIA thing for whatever reason. That's fine. And then you have the rest of the week to digest some economic data that I think is going to disappoint the equity market. It might be good for economies, disappoint the equity market.
One really important point is that Adobe closed down 14% on Friday after their earnings and their guidance. And this was a stock that had been underperforming many mega cap tech peers, specifically those in the the SaaS software space. This is a company that's thought to have many, many products that would benefit from Gen AI. They've been talking about the integration of this technology into them. They do have some competition from some upstarts, and then from obviously some big incumbents also, but the lack of story there, the lack of commercialization of generative AI is the thing that caused investors to hit the sell button kind of hard, Guy. And that speaks to what you were just talking about. So the fact is the market's open right now. We have Google up nearly 7% on just the story out of Bloomberg, okay, about the potential for this. We have Apple, which has not been able to get out of its own way, up 2%. And this might be the final, in my opinion, sort of rattle, if you want to call it, maybe a death rattle or so, that everybody's joined the party, and now it gets back to, Liz, a more sober environment of evaluating current valuations, what is the opportunity set, you know what I mean, what it does for margins, ultimately the current winners, and they've been anointed by the marketplace right here, how do they start getting, essentially, how do those stories become less interesting? And maybe if NVIDIA comes out and they basically give some commentary that supports that recent guidance, but it's not above those expectations, maybe that's the thing that basically causes investors to hit the pause button right now.
Perhaps. But I think the key word there is a pause button. I think we still are in a period where investors want the market to go up, and they're going to wish it and will it to be that way, or at least to make it go sideways until there's some sort of shock. We're also in this kind of waiting period between last earnings season and the next earnings season, where we don't have a ton of single company news coming out, and we're going to be more cued in on macro data and on macro commentary. So I think the bigger chance is that some of that macro stuff starts to be the shock or starts to be the catalyst to move things in one direction or another. And again, I don't know that I expect there to be a good reaction to even strong macro news or weak macro news. I think the market is actually confused about whether or not good news is good news or good news is bad news, or vice versa. So the Fed, and I will continue to say this until I either am proven wrong or proven right, I think the Fed has more stamina than the market to stay where they are. And I think they're going to have a higher threshold for pain than the market wants them to. We're not going to know the answer to that, though, until at this point, probably June, when we find out whether or not they start cutting rates as the market expects. So we've got still a waiting game in March, but I think Powell's commentary is going to be very important this week, and it'll be interesting to watch. And other fun tidbit, I didn't know you guys were having the Compound guys on this week. I am on the Compound and Friends this week. So that will happen after the Fed. We recorded on Thursday. I believe it drops on Friday.
All right, guys, just grinning ear to ear right there. The Compound Bros, they're going to be on with us on Thursday. Liz is going to be on with them on Friday. The answer to March Madness or sadness, hopefully we'll have by the end of the week a little bit. So we got a busy week here. Liz, we'll see you back on Market Call on Wednesday with us on the Risk Reversal Media page. We have Danny, Vinny, Porter, Steve Eisman on the Friday OTT drop. So check that out. Guy, you and I are just going to be doing it all week. I'll see you on the CNBC's Fast Money tonight, buddy.
No question about it. And congratulations to your Packers of Green Bay getting the safety from the New York Giants in the form of Xavier McKinney, young stud out of Alabama. Good for you. Paid up for that. And look at the Pittsburgh Steelers before we get out of here. Collecting quarterbacks in the form of Russell Wilson, who they got for basically nothing, and trading for Justin Fields. I mean, they gave up a fifth round draft pick or something. Now all of a sudden the Steelers have a couple quarterbacks in that camp, in that room, and they look legit going into next year, Dan Nathan.
Yeah, Justin Fields for a fifth round draft pick. That's pretty embarrassing, but it is what it is, Guy Adami. Caleb Williams is going to be a Chicago Bear. All right, folks, we'll see you all this week. Thanks, Liz. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
See ya.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, FactSet, and SoFi.
If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.
Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.